council meeting at Sierra Hills, being held at the community center in Sierra Hills, it is Tuesday, September 2021, at 7:02 PM. Thank you. Our pledge this evening will be by Councilmember Ellison, and our invocation will be by Councilmember Smith. Please join me in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this opportunity to come together as a council and staff and residents and discuss the needs of the city and look for solutions that are good compromises and help and not hinder the residents of the city. We are grateful for the freedoms that we enjoy and for our ability to gather and to do this good work. We're grateful for this city and for all those who contribute to it and say these things to the residents. Thank you. Our next item is the approval of the meeting's agenda. Mayor, I'd like to make a motion that we move item 11, the last 60, to item 7. Okay, I have a motion to move item number 11. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second. Okay, second by Councilmember Elder. Councilmember Elder.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellison.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Councilmember Guinness.
Aye.
Okay, we got unanimous, so we'll move that item up. So, Mayor Price, your item number 7 on our agenda, so I'll let you know when you're up. Okay, our next item is public comment. So is there anyone who just recently came who would like to make public comment who didn't get to sign up? Nope? Okay. We're okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, Kate Hugel Nielsen. That's me. Thank you. Come on up. All right. We have 3 minutes. Say your name and address, and you have 3 minutes to make a comment.
My name is Kate Hugel, and I'm Lisa Nielsen, and my address is 3963 West 9850 North in Cedar Hills. And is that all you needed for me to say?
Okay.
Okay. All right, I do have an Airbnb, so we're talking about that tonight. And thank you, Kelly, for answering me a lot on Facebook and so on. One of my neighbors is the one that connected me with that site at the time that this was a subject. Or else I wouldn't even have realized it. That was my reason for annexing into Cedar Hills a long time ago. I've been here a long time, even before Cedar Hills was here. I've been here that long. And I was even invited to be on the council. Thank you for all that you guys do. I declined because I said I liked being liked. So I know you can't always make everybody like you. But back at that time, I'm a pivotal piece of property. I'm right the line between Cedar Hills and Pleasant Grove. Pleasant Grove wanted us. Cedar Hills wanted us. I made lots of enemies because I decided to annex into Cedar Hills because I went to Pleasant Grove and Cedar Hills and wanted to know who would work best with me when it comes to having an Airbnb. Cedar Hills is the one that said that they would. And so that's why I annexed into Cedar Hills, was first annexed into Pleasant Grove, had to go into a lawsuit to get out of Pleasant Grove, back into Cedar Hills. And before I started my Airbnb recently, I did contact the city, make sure that everything was okay. And so that's where I've invested the last 30 years is to prepare for this. And that's what I'm doing right now. So now that it's a subject that we're talking about, I would be happy to share information, whatever you'd like to know. And I also wanted to mention, you might want to know your audience, a couple of things. There are so many things going on in Cedar Hills and nowhere to stay. And so they're staying outside of Cedar Hills, going outside of Cedar Hills instead of coming into Cedar Hills. I'm getting them from all over the world, so it's really cool. I'm really enjoying myself. The Timpanogos, the Loop, the Canyon, the Cave, and all the wedding venues around here, people want to stay close by. And they can't in Cedar Hills unless we do have the Airbnbs available to them. And my neighbor is the one that told me about this, and so she says, I have no complaints about having this happen, but I do think it is okay to have parking stipulations and quiet time and even a business license, dang it, if necessary. I have neighbors who have parties in their backyard all the time. And if you know where I live on 2 acres. So if I have a neighbor, they're like an acre away. And I can hear those parties going on. And that's somebody who owns their house and they don't have an Airbnb. I know that noise can be an issue, but it doesn't have to be an issue. Airbnb won't allow somebody to rent an Airbnb unless they comply to the last place they stayed. And I have rules they have to follow. And if they don't follow those rules, they can't stay anywhere again. And so that's something that I hope everybody can consider. They're not going to be bad neighbors just because it's an Airbnb.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. I'm just curious because I'm kind of learning about this. So do you live in the top and around the bottom, or do you live in the bottom and around the top?
Neither.
Okay.
The first floor is divided. So I actually live in the whole area unless I'm renting it out. And then I have somebody, two doors that come shut, and they have a private area with a bathroom and even a fridge and a microwave and a living room.
The house.
And also so the east side of the house is where we live when we do have guests. But when we don't have guests, we live in the entire thing.
Fine. Okay.
And I just want to say to you, knowing your audience, there's a lot of people of one denomination in this area. Many of them are going to be wanting to serve as senior missionaries, service missionaries. And I'm afraid that some of the worry in that is going to make it so that they can't rent out their own places while they're gone, or, like in my case, have somebody live in my side of my Airbnb and run it for me while I'm gone for a year or two. And so that's something else that I think you might want to consider.
Thank you, Karen.
Uh-huh.
All right, can I pass?
Kim Ross, 3751 West Box Elder Drive. I too have a short-term rental that I've been using for about the past little less than a year. It's both Airbnb and VRBO. I need a company that is my property manager, but I have rules that I currently use. With my house, my house is large enough that we live upstairs in the top two stories and the bottom basement, and there's a basement below that one, that is large enough for a large family to stay in. And I would just hope, and I just had the opportunity to read some of the specs that you're looking at. One is don't put a number on how many people can stay in a short-term rental, because everybody is in a different situation with their housing. We just heard that you split your house up in doing that. Mine is configured that the one basement is completely open or is completely separate, and then they have their own entrance. And it's about 2,500 square feet that they have. And so don't put a limit on how many people can stay in a short-term rental. The other concern that I have, and I too found out about this from my wife's Facebook post that you're even discussing this. I would suggest that you have something on your website that is saying we're looking at discussing this, rather than somebody posting it on the Cedar Hills chat room, that I have to look at my wife's Facebook to see that this meeting was even taking place tonight. So that was a concern that I had. The other one is don't limit it to certain numbers of short-term rentals in each area, okay? If you want to open up some corruption, then put a number on that. I have seen that exist in other areas where there's only a certain number of people that can have these. That breeds corruption. You need to have enough of these so that people want, when they want to come to the area, that they can stay. I too have had people, not from around the world, but all over the US. In fact, I would say 90% of the people that stay at our place is from out of state and not even in the West. They are coming here to enjoy the beauty of the area. And we need to, just like you don't limit the number of rentals that people can have in an apartment building or in a housing, don't limit the number of short-term rentals. We don't have hotels in here. And the ones that do are considerable ways away.
Sorry.
I know the 3 minutes.
I wanted to address something about the not posting about the meetings. Every 5 days before every meeting, the agenda and the packets posted on the city website and in 3 other locations, 2 different, one city Facebook page and then 2 other just private.
But how do I know that this is going to be on the meeting unless I look at that every 5 days before that? If you would put it on the Monday email that goes out to everybody,
it's there. So you can go and you just click on it. It doesn't say here's all our items. It says here's the package.
Here's what's coming up next and how the day's coming up.
It's, yeah, but it's not one click.
The link is. The link is. You click it.
If you know what the link is, you might be able to do it. But I tell you, finding that link sometimes is not difficult. Just like I went into the city code.
Okay, we'll try
that is not easy to find.
We'll try and make it one click. We'll see what we can do.
I know everything about all of the youth activities from that Monday email. But when it comes to things that the city council is doing, there's not much information there. I would rather see something on that saying the city council is discussing this. We're looking at doing this on there so everyone knows that we're going to be discussing this in the upcoming meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right,
JP Frank.
Your name and address,
and
you've got 3 minutes.
John Frank, 9076 Canyon Heights Drive. I got a letter, code violation, complaint, a courtesy notice about parking my work van in front of my home. This isn't an 18-wheeler. It's a little Ford Transit van. It just has full plumbing on the roof. I drive home from work every day. I want to know why this has happened. I've been parking there for 12 years and never had a problem. And now they're saying they're going to find and arrest me. So I guess that's it. I don't have a lot to say about it. I'd just like some answers about that and know why it's happening. You know, I guarantee there are city workers that take their trucks home, park on the street, school bus drivers, police officers. Those are all commercial vehicles. It's the same thing. So I don't know if they're all going to be arrested too.
Sir, if you'll share your name and number with me again, I will get in touch with you tomorrow.
Okay. JP John Paul Frank, FRANCK, 801-372-1726.
You get a call from me tomorrow. We'll talk about it, okay? Is that okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Don Simon. Your name, address, and you've got 3 minutes.
Donald Simons, 3817 West Valley View Drive.
Hold on 1 second.
You probably wouldn't hear. Well, maybe. So I wasn't planning on standing up and commenting, the only reason is because of the small numbers that are here that I did. I haven't done a lot of research on the RV parking ordinance that was passed. I did read some of the posts on the Facebook, and it concerns me. We have an RV. Well, we had an RV up until 2 weeks ago when it caught fire in Wyoming, and it's a total loss now. But I plan to have another RV soon. Okay. We bring our RV to our house in front. We prepare for it. We do minor repairs, washing the windows, things like that to get ready for our trip. We plug it in. My wife spends a few days getting the refrigerator cold, getting all the supplies that we need. Extra blankets, and, you know, just things that we want to take with us, our barbecues and things that we don't leave in it. That's not a 1 or 2 hour process. And so it's normally a several day process to have in front of our house. We don't store it there. We don't park it there for weeks on end, but sometimes it might be there for 4 or 5 days. And I think it's crazy. We do pay taxes for the license fees for the use of the roads. It is a licensed, insured vehicle. It's like this gentleman should be able to park his vehicle on the streets. It's not there for storage. And it's a huge inconvenience if we have to take everything that we're going to take down and not have it right there to get ready. Not be able to bring it up. And I've been cited before with the old ordinance. I guess maybe a neighbor complained to the code enforcement officer who came out and gave us a ticket. Or a red slip, not a ticket, but a warning. And so I researched on the ordinance for parking it and then followed that. And then I got another red ticket, the red warning. So I called the code enforcement officer at that time, and this is maybe 2 years ago. It was a long time ago. And told her, I followed your ordinance. It's not been parked there. It was parked there for 2 days, and then we took it, got some propane, got some other things. It was gone for several hours, okay? And it was parked in it. We don't have much room in front of our house, but it was moved in a different location. Not far enough, I guess. But please don't make me have to move it after just a few hours. You know, one day is really a few hours because you go to work and we come home. I work till 6 in Bountiful. I get home at 7. I have about an hour.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Okay, that's the end of our public comment portion of this meeting. Can I make a comment? Yes.
She came in late.
Oh, I had a problem with my hand. Yes. Okay, go ahead. Just state your name. And you have 3 minutes. Okay, hi. I'm Laura Johnson. My address is 10312 North 4th Street Drive. So I am a trailer owner and basement apartment owner. So on the trailers, I just want to say I think the 48 hours was good. I feel like that's good when we go camping. If we leave on a Saturday, we'll pull our trailer out on Thursday night when my husband's off work. That way Friday I can clean it, get ready, leave on Saturday. So I feel like 48 hours was good. I kind of feel like part of the problem is the city wasn't actually enforcing the previous code. From what I read on Facebook, which is just hearsay, I think there's even a council member who posts who parks their trailer long term on the street. So, okay. So, you know, I just think it wasn't being enforced. And so I don't think the timing is short, it just is watched carefully. Second of all, we have a basement apartment. I've lived in Cedar Hills for 12 years, and then my second house in Cedar Hills, because we really like it. It's lovely. We love it. So we wanted to buy a little bit bigger house, but I don't work. I stay at home with our kids. And so in order for us to be able to get to a different house, we needed a basement apartment to offset that, because it was either income from basement apartment or me go to work. Because house prices are, you know, fun crazy. So that's what we did, and our plan is, it'll be at least 8 years, but we would like to build an Airbnb our apartment. We actually, before we bought our house, I went and talked to Jim Tay, who was quite nice, and I did a gamma request, I think it's called, so I could check all the, what, is that right?
Ground.
Okay. I did that because I wanted to make sure the house we were buying was going to be in code, and we could work with it, we want to work with the city, we had to register our apartment, we did all the things the city asked. And so now to hear that they might limit the amount of Airbnbs to 2 per voting district. I know just in my neighborhood, I can count at least 9 basement apartments. Like, there's a ton, right? And so I'm like, we can't Airbnb for at least 8 years because that's when my lab kid will graduate high school. So, like, that's not in our cards at the moment, but when that time comes, I want to be able to do that. We wanted the space to be flexible. I have 4 girls, and I'm like,
What if one of them gets divorced? What if one of them's in an abusive relationship? What if something happens and they need to move home? We wanted to keep that space flexible. So when we get to that point, we want to be able to have that flexibility by doing Airbnb. So it's really nice to hear from these people that have the Airbnbs that they're going well. Because I was curious about that. So I don't know. I think it's fine for the city to do a business license and maybe have you register your apartment so you guys can kind of keep your thumb on how many you're having. Like, I think that's fine, but when it comes to limiting them, I don't feel like that's proper. Oh, I also wanted to add real fast. I commented on Facebook about Eagle Mountain. Some of the streets that are really narrow, they paint one side red. Yeah, have you seen those? Yeah. Because like they say, the street's so narrow, one side's red, and you don't pick and choose which one. You say, all the North Street's red, all the East Street's red, and that kind of helps.
There are public hearings on a couple things, right? So
yes.
The ones that say public hearing, you can always jump in when it's a public hearing too, and talk. So that just helps people get in there.
Yeah, I'm pretty uneducated when it comes to this.
That's all good. Name and address.
Luke Applington. My address is 10097 West State Road West. And my comment is about the triggers and the parking lot. So, just a couple things about it. I have a couple of trailers, and they're not recreational trailers. For my second job, which is landscaping. And the reason I have the second job is because I don't make enough of the first job. There was one comment, or I don't know, on the web page that was talking about, but when you buy a trailer, you should kind of have a place to park it. Yeah, in a perfect world. But when you don't make enough money, and so you have to have a trailer to help you make money, you have to plan. And your house is already small, so your lot is small because you don't make enough money to have a bigger lot. If that makes sense. So, right now, because of this new ordinance, I have both my trailers in my parking lot, or in my driveway, and I have my vehicles in the street. Now, in the winter, I can park next to my house with my trailers, and I store them there, but there is only an inch on each side of hitting my house and hitting the fence, so that's a one-time store for the winter. Then in the summer, I can pull it out. I can't keep going back and forth, because it takes me hours just to make sure I'm not hitting my neighbor's fence and hitting my house, just how my block is situated. And then another comment on there was, I think it was, said, with changing the ordinance, or not changing it, I'm not going to be able to make any of that for everyone. So the question is why was it changed? It's obviously trying to make somebody happy. I don't think that having it the way it was pleasing to us actors. But we dealt with it. Right? Changing it is saying the one or two people that are in the neighborhood that are complaining about it so that it would get tagged, let's make that happen. Versus the people that are trying to actually make a living. Now, I'll live by the old way, and I'll live by the new way, whatever it is, but I think that there should be a consideration for more than just one person. More this one person.
Thank you. Okay. And move on. Are we done? I think so. Okay. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate everyone's comments. It makes a big difference to us when you come and bring these issues to us and come to a meeting. There are times where we come and sit in these meetings, there's not a single person sitting out there. And then, okay. And then we make a decision, and then, you know, we're upset. There was nobody here.
I'm happy that you're here, and I appreciate that. All right, city reports and business. Mr. Goodwin.
Thank you, Mayor. In the recreation department, we have flag football, soccer, cot soccer, team flag football. We're off to a great start for our fall sports, and we're utilizing Harvey Park for the football for the first time, so we're grateful for that park's availability to us. excuse me. The event staff had a really tough year last year, and so we wanted to recognize them that they've actually had a really great job. They've done a really great job of rebounding, and I believe it was last month, Greg, they had their highest revenue month in the history of the Vista Room, right?
July?
Was it July? Okay, thank you. So they're really doing a good job getting the word out there and working with clients, so I want to commend them. They're doing great. And golf is also in the middle of a crazy tournament time. They have 5 tournaments this week and 4 next week, so they're quite busy. That's why we're down here tonight, is so that they can set up for a tournament event upstairs. But we're excited for what they're doing at the golf course. They have a tournament they're going to hold called the Halloween called the Gruesome Foursome. I actually don't know what that means. But we look forward to the golf staff trying some new things, so we commend them as well. In citywide business, we wanted to just kind of put out there that we're going to talk about this tonight, but the irrigation water, we are planning on shutting it off on the week of October 1st, sometime that week. And we'll talk more about that later this evening, about why that is. And we've talked about that before, so that date shouldn't come as a surprise to the council, but we want to let you guys know where we are on our water resources and what our plans are for the future. The fire department is having an open house. I believe it's October 18th. I can't remember the exact date. I'm looking at Cameron like he knows, but he doesn't. So that's a great opportunity to come meet the American Fork Fire Rescue, see their equipment, and grab a hot dog. And then finally, last night, I have a few residents that ping me about this item a few times a year. The fiber committee met with a couple of companies that have responded to the RFP. And they will have a recommendation to the council hopefully next month. So you should be having some good in-depth discussions on fiber in the coming 2 months. That's all I have. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember
Gaddis,
do you have anything to report?
I'm going to report.
So we've been working on the YCC, getting the YCC up and going. There's what YCC is. Sorry, the Youth City Council. They're going to present tonight, but Councilmember Allison and I have been working on that, and it's been really exciting. They have a really good group, and they've got some exciting news to them. So we've been doing that. We just had a night in social the other night, and it was really fun to get them together and kind of see what direction they want to take their initiatives to the city. And then I'm also on the Lake Commission, and I met with the head of the commission today, and there's some super exciting things coming up out around the lake, and so we're going to see if maybe we can highlight a few of those in the city newsletter, just so that people start to kind of see what's coming. There's been some added funds, and just some exciting things that are coming that direction, so I'll sit on that commission and keep you updated on some of the things we're doing.
What lake is that? Newsletter, and I'll leave what you want for this conference for anyone who's a caregiver.
And also an informational piece from that is that by the end of the century, Utah County is going to be the largest county in the state. So, catching up. That's all I have. Councilmember Ellison?
I don't have anything other than just echoing Councilwoman Smith. We're just working with these youth. City Council has been inspiring and so much fun. These youth are amazing. I don't think I was that responsible when I was their age, but we have a lot of things coming up and a lot of things that they want to be involved in help with. So,
I wanted to thank those that showed up tonight and for their thoughtful comments. They will be considered by the council. Also, the town hall with John Curtis was well attended. That was about 2 weeks ago. I wasn't able to make it at a last minute conflict, but I heard that it was a really good turnout and some good questions. It feels like we're getting some increased community participation, and I think things are trending to where people are participating more and want to be aware of what's going on. That's great.
Thank you.
No, I don't have anything to
say. Great,
thank you. Okay, we'll move on to our scheduled items and public hearings. Item number 6 is a review action public hearing on an ordinance amending the official zoning map. Rezoning 9561 North Canyon Road from the PR2.2 planned residential zone to the R1-15,000 residential zone. Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Mayor.
Teenage driver.
First of all, let me say that I'm really grateful for everyone to be here. I really am. I like hearing feedback from the community. I like knowing how the residents feel about things. It gives us good direction. If you want to be informed about what the city council is doing, I would recommend reach out to the city council. Reach out to city staff. We have a list that goes out. If you want to be on the email that gets the agenda, the link to the agenda every week we have a meeting, we're happy to add you to that list. Send us your email. We will add you to that list happily. We want people to know what's happening in the city. When we have, like on the community parking as an example, when we talk about parking, we talked about it, no one's here. And I wanted to hear this feedback, so I'm glad that you're here tonight. Before we get there, let's talk about zoning. Let me pull up a zoning map real fast. So, the property in question is downtown south side of the city. This would be what the new zoning map would look like. It's this property right here, the center screen. It's purple right now, purple indicating that it would be moved to the R1 15,000, meaning it's residential, one unit, 15,000 square feet for the yard. At least 50,000 square feet per year. Currently, it sits in the PR 2.2 zone, which is planned residential, 2.2 units per acre. Right. So the owner, the property owner here, it's an older home, and I believe that it was some of their land that they used to subdivide some land around it. But they wish to have large animal unit rights, and they currently don't have that in the PR 2.2 zone, but they would have it in the R1 15,000 zone. One of the things we look at when we're looking at rezoning property is, will this create an island? So if it was, I'm going to pick on this person down in the corner here. If it was this individual here down in the corner, he said, I want large animal rights, so would you please consider moving me to the to the R1 15,000 zone? I look at that and I'd say, I'll take the proposal to the Planning Commission, but I'm not going to recommend it because I'm not going to want an island in a zone all by itself. But you can see that this one does tie in with other R1 15,000 zone homes along in that area, adjacent to Canyon Road. One of the reasons that people like to rezone is that they may get added density so that when they want to subdivide their property, they can add an extra hall. In the PR 2.2 zone, he actually has enough land that he wants to currently, in his current zone, he could subdivide that and add one more single family unit. By moving to the R1 15,000 zone, he maintains that right but does not get another unit, so he doesn't get any added density. With that being said, I think this is a fairly simple rezoning request, but I'm happy to answer any questions in this public hearing ordinance.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Goodwin?
Yeah, the session is pretty straightforward. Is the applicant here? No, not that I know of.
You want to know if it was horses or cows?
Or llamas.
Or llamas. Could be llamas.
Well, no, alpine, camels, so.
Yeah. Well, if there are no questions, then we can end the session. We will open it up to the public hearing portion of this item. If there's anyone here that would like to speak to this item, seeing none, we will move out of that public hearing portion and I will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve ordinance 9-14-2021A, amending the Cedar Hill City official zoning map by rezoning the property located at 9651 North Canyon Road from the PR 2.2 planned residential zone to the R1 15,000 residential zone.
Thank you. I have a motion by Councilmember Miller. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellison.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Okay, that passes unanimously. So move on to our next item, which is item number 7.
Yes, they are item number seven.
Mm-hmm. Our youth city council mayor is here with us, Mayor Charles Price. Also, I see Cheryl, and is there anybody? Yes. Yeah. All right, tell me your name.
Asher.
Okay, so I will invite Mayor Price and Cheryl Nasher to come up with him. And Mayor Price is going to give us a presentation on what the licensee is going to get.
Hello. As Mayor Anderson previously mentioned, my name is Charles Price. I am the mayor of our youth city council here in Cedar Hills.
I'm Cheryl Sid. I'm the treasurer of the city council.
I'm Ashley Beeson. I do not work for this.
You're our honor council member.
A wonderful and valued member of the city council. To my knowledge, we have roughly 26 members of our 2021-2022 Youth City Council, and we are very excited they have all been selected because we believe that they have the potential to create great benefits and impact on our community. Some of our goals as Youth City Council this year is to make the youth a lot more involved, both in community events and also in our city government. So we're very excited as the Youth City Council to be able to learn from our City Council and be able to attend this hearing and understand more about the function of our city. Currently, we have a few items that we are working on in relation to our responsibilities in city events. We are planning on hosting and formulating the Santa Night that we will be holding in December, as well as potential Halloween activity in October, and finding out what other ways we can improve the youth's interaction with the city with different events, such as potential Easter egg hunts and things inside the family festival coming up next summer. Hopefully we can be able to improve our knowledge of city government and be able to improve our ways to help the city by attending a collaboration with the Highland Youth City Council in September. Hopefully that can improve our knowledge, and as well as a special event at the Capitol building to that is for specifically for youth city councils and youth in that position to try and educate us on how to do that. So we are extremely excited to be working with you guys this year and to be able to learn and hopefully make some positive impact on our community. If Cheryl, I'm not sure about closing remarks.
Put the pressure on.
Anything?
So, in that case, then I think that's all we have for communication.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
How do kids get involved in that? Like, my kids work.
Application process is closed, but we have so 9th through 12th grade.
Okay.
They can.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, she also next year, that'd be great. Applications
cool.
Usually in the summer, and then because we run kind of by the school year. But because
okay.
They have the school year, they finish with family festival, and then we get new, and they're welcome to stay on until they're senior.
Thank you.
I appreciate you.
Mm-hmm. In relation to that, once they're on, do they stay on there until they want
to
leave? They have to reapply every year.
Yeah. I feel like a proud mother right now. I'm not Charlie since he was a baby.
So
but to answer your question, we don't limit the number. So even if they stay on, we welcome our kids to come in.
So there's not a limit?
No.
The more youth, the better.
More
youth, the
more
competition.
So thank you. We can stay or you can go. Probably
it's going to get interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, so we're going to move on to our new item number 8, which was item number 7, and that is review action on adopting the proposed city code 10-5-41 residential short-term rentals. Mr. Gable, before you start, can I just say I appreciate people staying, even when people come and comment, then they leave, and then we're like, wait, we didn't have a conversation yet. And so sometimes you come and comment, and then you go, and you don't even know what we talked about, which you can hear later when we do the recording. So I appreciate when you come and give us a comment that you stay to hear our discussion so that we can kind of tell you where we're at, and so you understand, you know, kind of maybe the other side or some other points we can consider. So thank you for staying.
One of the map you put together today will pass in a second.
We're on the short term one.
Yes. So let me start by saying how we got here. Like, the code goes through a process. It's not just we draft something, bring it to you, pass it, and it goes into implementation. It's slightly more complicated than that, but not much. When we recognize that there's an issue in the community, we want to address it. So in this case, over the years, we've seen that there is an issue with parking. There's an issue with short-term rentals,
yeah.
Too. Getting ahead of myself, I apologize.
Okay.
We'll do them all, right, at the same time. So, okay. All right, okay. So on short-term rentals, I apologize. So, back to the issue, because the what I was going to say still applies, is that when we propose code, we have an issue in the city that we need to address, in this case, short-term rentals, whether it's parking, whether it's ground rents, or we're going to talk about all three tonight. Staff works with the city attorney to draft code, and a lot of times we look at what other cities are doing around us, what other cities, we find out what's working for them, what's not working for them. And we take that draft code, and if it's in Title 10, which is everything that issue that deals with land use issues, it goes to the Planning Commission. And the Planning Commission will spend a meeting or two or three or however many it takes to mull over an idea or mull over an issue and put their input into it. And so on the short-term rental, the Planning Commission felt like it was necessary to have a limit on the number of short-term rentals in the city. And as I mentioned in the work session, there's a dynamic at play here, whether it's you have to take the individual property rights, saying allowing people to do what they wish with their property, and balance that with what's good for the community. And when we're talking about land use, that's usually the dynamic that's at play. So anything we talk about tonight, that's really kind of the foundational issue that that's behind some of this ideology. But the nice thing about it is the Planning Commission makes this recommendation, and it comes to the City Council, and then the City Council can say, you know what, this is how we feel we need to implement this code. And the city council has the final say on this. So as the code is presented tonight, is that we recognize that short-term rentals are becoming more and more ubiquitous in our community. They're found everywhere, and a lot of people rely on them for their ability to meet mortgage payments. It doesn't qualify, obviously, as moderate income housing, but it does allow people to meet income. And that's like where I think it's very important to allow this. And so that's why this issue came up. However, we have seen issues over the years. If you've gone to any of the Utah League and Cities and Towns conferences, you'll know that as we talk about short-term rentals, inevitably the discussion ends up on the impact that a short-term rental can have on a neighborhood. And that impact is usually always dealing with the nuisances that can come with a short-term rental. And this includes, I would say, the top two are parking and noise. So one way to mitigate that, and that's why we're trying to keep the code as it is being proposed, is that when there's a property owner on site, when the property owner is in the home at the time of the rental, much of the nuisance issue goes away because there's somebody there that is accountable for what's happening on the property. So in this case, the proposed code states that the owner of the subject property shall live in the primary dwelling in which the short-term rental is desired and must reside there as their primary residence. It goes on to talk about that the occupancy that has to occur during the rental period. So you can't leave for a week and rent your property out for that week and then come back and see what the impact was. You have to be there for that period. There is a maximum occupancy, and that's to 8 related people and 4 unrelated people. And like I said, we pull code from other cities, and sometimes there's, I'm sure this 8 related people is something that was pulled from another city. The reason that 4 unrelated people is the way it is actually based on our current code. If you look in section titled 10-2 in the definitions for land use, it has a definition for a family, and there's a few definitions of how we define a household unit in the city. One of them being 4 unrelated individuals living together as a housekeeping unit. So 4 people living together to make ends meet. So that's what we decide, that's what the city code regulates as a group living arrangement. And so if I wanted to have me and 5 of my friends live in the same home, I exceed that by 2 individuals, right? That does not meet the code. So there would have to be some changes there. And so we do have individuals in over the years that have rented out rooms to other individuals to make ends meet. But we recognize that in most cases, if I were to rent out my home and I were rented out to 6 other people, then in all 6 unrelated individuals, in all likelihood, there's 6 cars, additional cars that are probably needing to be parked on the property, which goes back to the nuisance. What's the impact on the surrounding neighborhood? And typically, it's parking noise. Going forward, we limit the property to having the short-term rental for 182 nights per year. That is common in most city code. It's not 100% of cities, but the rationale behind 182 is that it's slightly less than half a year. If you have an accessory dwelling unit an approved accessory dwelling unit in the home, then we say that you can rent it up to 365 days per year, because technically the impact is the same, whether it's a short-term rental or an ADU. We've talked about parking, that in the approval process, they would have to show a parking plan to ensure that there's enough, that there's adequate off-street parking. And then there's posting requirements, because we want the people that are staying in short-term rental to be informed about what the rules and what the expectations are for them when they're there. And so it's that there's a city issue, business license, there's parking requirements, there's maximum occupancy, there's a noise ordinance for the police, so they can see in a noticeable place what's being expected of them. And then the Planning Commission felt like there needed to be a limit on the number of short-term rentals in the community. And so what they did was they wanted to say, well, how do we break down the city into smaller, units of community in a way to make this measurable in some manner? And they decided on the voting precincts. We have 5 voting precincts in the community, and this will be the way. Right? I'm going to use Serials 3. Serials 3 is our biggest voting precinct, and there are, in this purple area, it's one of our more dense neighborhoods, too. It's, you know, the townhomes up here on the hillside. It's not the most dense, but it's up there. But you have 723 units. So based on the formula, which is 2 plus 1 per 200 homes, you would have to have 5 for rentals in this entire neighborhood. Now, the reason that that was is they wanted to mitigate those impacts that you feel when you are living next to a short-term rental. The question is again, balancing what should the individual property right owner have versus what's good for the community. Well, I do think we talked about this in the work session, that when the owner is present on site during the rental, many of the issues are set aside. So we have a number of ADUs in the community, and for the most part, we don't have parking issues. We don't have noise issues because the ADU requires that the homeowner live in the home so that it's not just a rental. But we do have problems with rentals when the owner's not there. But in this case, in the short-term rental case, in the ADU case, we would require that under the current code, under the proposed code, we would require that the owner be present for the rent. So with that being said, I'd love to hear questions that were raised from the residents that have come tonight. We do have a public hearing on this, so if you want to hear some questions, I'd love to hear them. If you have questions, I'd love to hear them.
Now we're talking in the open hearing, so if there's any discussion that you'd like to
This code doesn't impact the ADU code.
No. But you can still have an ADU in every zone of the city, except for the redevelopment right there. An ADU is an accessory dwelling unit. Based on the model, it's an ADU.
Accessory dwelling unit. Your apartment.
Yeah.
An apartment.
So this would not preclude anyone from having an ADU or a basement apartment. You can still have those everywhere in the city except for one zone called PD1 zone, which is right there. They're the only residential zone in the city is not allowed to have ADUs.
So anyone in the other rest of the city that has a basement that they want to rent out longer than 29 days,
yes,
is fine.
Yes.
But even with those, if you look at our ADU code, it has to be owner-occupied. Because
yes.
Can't have a family that lives upstairs and a different guy that lives in the basement. So we're kind of trying to bring these two codes together, too. If that's our role for long-term renters, we need to kind of make some similarities between short-term renters, right? So, and that's, and part of that is state law. So House Bill 82 made it where every city had to allow ADUs. And even HOAs can't pursue that.
And part of the reason that is important is because the state requires the city, as part of their general plan, to have what's called moderate income housing only. And this may pose a shock to you, but housing is really, really expensive in the North Dakota. So if you look at what qualifies as moderate income housing, we don't have it. So the state's really making this push for cities to generate this moderate income housing. But the only way that we can do that, the only way we can comply with some of the state requirements when it comes to moderate income housing, is to allow ADUs to go. So we made that decision, I'll say, 2 or 3 years ago.
So in the, what's the actual name of that community again?
Cedar Canyon.
So in Cedar Canyon, I know they can't have an ADU, but could they have a short-term rental?
No.
Well, I mean, they could rent a room.
Yeah,
I
suppose. They could rent a room.
They
could get into the room.
They have the parking lot.
Yeah. So it'd be limited in the number of nights.
And the ADU was in the original settlement conditions, correct?
Just so everybody knows, during working session, we did have a pretty in-depth discussion on this, and I do think a lot of stuff we talked about is valuable to bring back up. I had a couple thoughts. I do want to add a few more based on what I've heard from comments earlier. First off, it's not clear where the HOAs stand. Currently, the HOAs could make their own rules around this, from my understanding. They have, it's not, they're not called out specifically. It's being given.
But the plan is that it would have to be, they can't allow something that the city prohibits.
Right.
So it would be more stringent or restrictive, not less.
Right. So have that expectation if you're in an HOA like I am, things it will be slightly different. The second part of this is we had a lot of discussion about not restricting the numbers and things along those lines. I do follow in line with allowing more than what they proposed, putting caps on it. I don't think that's going to have any value because we have means to take care of issues via business licenses and nuisance laws, those types of things. I think we have other ways to deal with what the planning commission was determining. And those are the things I'd like to have staff go back and look at. And the last comment, based on the experiences that we shared, I would love to have a little bit of work done researching what the rules are that the various companies have for people who sign up to put a rental on their site. So does, you know, VRBO and Airbnb, do they have specific requirements that owner would also have to meet there that they would benefit from as a city? Because I don't think we have to go too far. I think market forces control a heck of a lot of the issues that the planning commission brought up. Those are my thoughts on all of this. I'd just like to see it go back and get revisited and take
those into consideration. And then I can answer some of that. We own a, we own my rentals in St. George. And so we advertise on Airbnb and on VRBO. We have whole homes that are in 90 rental zones, which is what St. George does. They have no requirements, except that if you tell them that one of these is in a prohibited zone, they can research that themselves and they will take you off the platform. But besides that, there's no cleanliness or noise ordinances, and they have no teeth for those.
So
they don't enforce anything.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about that part. I would just want to be able to leverage the portion where if it is a consistent nuisance, there is some method to get correction, right?
I think that's on our end now, beyond the Airbnb.
We have that in the proposed code. It starts out with any violation. It starts off with just a notice, right? It would have to be pretty egregious to go too straight towards a fine. But for the first violation in a 12-month period, penalty on this is $500. It's quite steep. The second one within 12-month period, $750. And then on the third, $1,000, and the revocation of business license and conditional use permit.
So not alone.
And a two-year timeout, so.
But that's what you're saying, Jerry, that I agree with, that those things are in place to help so that we don't maybe have to regulate it so far. Because if those things are in place, then they'll have to take care of itself. Because maybe the owner is going to do something about it or be more careful. You know, we'll have to call it here.
So,
but, yeah, go ahead. I'm just saying that I agree with that.
I would just like to say this is kind of a market-driven industry, and it's, you know, if you cause problems with your neighbors and it gets worked it out, and the libertarian market-driven entrepreneurial myself says let that govern it more than anything. I hate regulations, and I think limiting to two is ridiculous, and I think there should be no limits as long as they comply with all the other conditions, and they're pretty stringent, I think, the conditions that we're placing on them. So, I mean, I personally stayed in a few of them. Some are better than others, but the sites also have ways to give you stars or rankings and all kinds of stuff. If you're a crappy renter, they don't let you rent, and people know that. And so, it kind of doesn't get out of control. You, at least in my limited experience, my sister owns a bunch of them, and the last thing those owners want to get is some like 4 stars or what 1 star, whatever it is. I don't know what it ever knocks you down. I mean, that just kills you in the business.
Can I touch on the enforcement aspect? Just because I don't think that it's not based on my neighbor doesn't like me, so they called in a complaint and I got fined. It's not that. It doesn't work like that. If this is more like I had a renter, they were told a vendor downstairs and the police had to come out. I have a police report and a witness of what happened, and then I issue a violation. If I don't see a violation line out there, I'm not issuing anything. So there's not that, trying to remove that level of arbitrariness from the equation.
I mean, I just don't see, I mean, this is a bedroom, quiet Cedar Hills community, right? I mean, we're not getting the high school or the college parties, spring break. That's not who our clientele, that's not who would rent ever in Cedar Hills, I don't think. I mean, you're shaking your head. President Russ shaking his head, I don't know. I'm just thinking, this is a nice, comfortable place for people that want to experience the canyons, the temple, whatever it is. And I just don't see any problem with it,
personally. I just wanted to say a couple things. I'm not for the limits of all either. I actually attended the Planning Commission because it's been a Planning Commission for so long that I wanted to go and hear what they were still talking about. So, and I love that they spent that time on it. If you really want to see code, go to the Planning Commission because they dive really deep and that's their job. And for the most part, we listen to their recommendations. But then we hit things like this where we just don't see the need that they see. And it's nice to have both of us. And that was the first thing that I wrote down is I don't love those limits. I feel like it picks winners and losers. It's just unnecessary. If our code's written correctly, we just don't need that extra piece. And then I wanted to say a few things just so people know. House Bill 253 was supposed to, this was back in 2017, it was supposed to allow short-term rentals everywhere. That did not pass. And so what they also put in there was that we can't, as a city, troll Airbnb and VRBO and just arbitrarily look for people who are just advertising. And then go and say, do you have a business license? Have you done what you're supposed to do? We can't do that. So that something like that isn't going to happen to Chandler's point. It's actually illegal, and that's not what we're looking for. If there's no problem in the neighborhood, then nobody's going to call you. Like, we're not going to come and talk to you. But if we have to come and talk to you, and you were supposed to get a business license, and you didn't get a business license, then that's where the issues start to come up. And so we want to make the rules so wide, I guess, that we encourage people to do it and we encourage people to follow the rules that we have so that we can also protect the other neighbors. The other thing was the limit on the number of people. So that would just be tricky just because we were looking at our other code. And I don't know if people remember that we changed the times of the parks. That was to bring our parks in compliance with our regular noise ordinance. So if you couldn't play basketball in your front yard at 11, you really shouldn't be playing pickleball down at Harvey, right? So some of those things are trying to get code the same. Doesn't mean we can't change another code, but we do like for them not to be in conflict with each other. So that's something, I mean, it's not set in stone, but we don't also consider other codes.
The one I think I grapple with more is the limit on related people. It's 8, that's like what an average family has. But it's not uncommon to have more than 8 people that are related that are looking to stay in a large short-term rental.
Yeah.
So I think that would be one that we don't limit the number of related people that are in regular home. So I think that might be something that we could consider saying, we're going to move that. And then maybe we revisit at a future date our family code and what our group limitations are.
And then the renter, you would know before somebody comes in how many people there are, right? So they would have the opportunity to say, you want to bring this many people and I only have this much space, that's going to be, that's kind of what we're talking about, right?
Hopefully they self-select out saying I have 12 people and there's 500 square feet here, this isn't good. But,
that's again why I said the market regulates itself, really. I really think it does. And so, if it would be my recommendation, I'd like to table it, go back to the staff, even on a fair plan for some side again. But, They're not elected body, it's like it's...
I don't think we need to set it. We're
the elected body, we need to make the decision. I appreciate the recommendation, the study and everything, but, you know, make a few tweaks that we talked about, and I'd like to see this again. I don't think there's urgency in this right now, but...
No, I think this is what we want to get right.
Exactly. I'll
jump in with a comment. I agree. I think that we shouldn't make any decisions tonight. We're kind of getting the ball rolling on this, so to speak. And we want to be prudent and careful about it. I also agree that there should not be a limit of the number of short-term rentals in owner-occupied homes. In fact, I might go a step further that perhaps I would be okay with a limited number of short-term rentals that were not homeowner-occupied. I know that that's not probably a favorable perception from the city, but the dynamics of our community can change. As Mr. Goodwin mentioned, there is the possibility of Snowbird opening up access through American Gore Canyon, which would greatly change the dynamics of our community. There's talk of doing a gondola. People would be accessing the ski resort through our canyon, and we're right at the mouth of it. And to handcuff people to where they potentially, you know, lose out on the opportunity to make a lot of money, if it's well regulated, I think it can be done. You know, I think it would take increased code enforcement. But anyway, that's where I don't think we should limit the ones that we're talking about, whether homeowner occupied. And I'm open to a well-regulated, limited number of non-homeowner occupied.
That's an interesting idea because if you look at some of the homes that were in, like, creative homes, like, you know, one that was down in Spanish Fork, I believe, up against a mountain, very big house, not going to be homeowner occupied. It was planned to be an Airbnb, but it's also planned to be like a resort for families to go for a week vacation or something along those lines. I think we might have some properties that would potentially fall into that category. So that is something to look ahead at. I don't think we have anything in terms now that somebody's jumping on it, but keep an eye on that.
I kind of agree with both those things.
Yeah, I know we don't. I just wanted to mention I did a ton of research, and what we keep getting from the state over and over again, and it hasn't been that hard, hasn't passed yet, is allowing the owner-occupied ones. They have not discussed the non-homeowner-occupied ones because they're seeing issues in Moab and in Park City and places where they've made it where those they don't even have regular neighborhoods anymore. And so the state doesn't love that one because we're already in a housing crunch, and if we, because of the potential of income, if we turn every empty house into a hotel, then we're going to have trouble with people who just need to find a place to rent because there's so much more income in it. It's triple. So they don't love that for that reason. We're saying that we're opening up all these other doors so that people can find a place to rent, or people can afford to keep their home. Well, you can afford to get out of it, right? But you just want to keep it as a hotel. Well, then that would be what the state's been saying is we need more moderate.
But you're talking about the non-owner-occupied person.
Right.
When it's non-owner-occupied person, they're taking buying a house for the sole purpose of it being a short-term rental, and thereby reducing the housing stock in the area for people looking for long-term housing.
Yes, right. So the legislation that keeps coming down keeps saying owner-occupied because the state doesn't want to eliminate and have Moab and Park City everywhere where people can't. There's no homes anymore.
So a perfect example of this, I'll tell you, it's happening right now in IE in Hawaii. So that's the home would be like Hawaii. I went to school there and lived there with my family for 6 years. They lived there. I lived there a couple of years. But, people have bought up all the houses in Miami. There's no houses for any students to live in. And because they can all make so much more money Airbnb in their houses, and that's really caused a problem. And I don't see that an issue here, but that's a true problem. And I know that probably when our state legislature came in, it's happened.
And that's how St. George is mitigated with those zones. So I had to pay double what I pay for my home in the 90 rental zones, and I could buy down the street in the non-90 rental zones the income I can generate. And so there you have to live in micro rental zone. There's a few of them. or you create zones, as you have.
Yeah.
That also puts people who don't want to be in a non-universal zone in a non-universal zone. So that the other problem with being in a non-universal zone is you cannot apply for the exemption. There's an exemption that you can get. So if you rent your home to someone who doesn't already own a home, you can apply for the primary residential exemption for your taxes. If you live in a non-universal zone, no matter how you lease that home, you may not apply for that exemption. And so that landlocked a lot of people. So a lot of people, if they're not in a nightly rental, they don't want to be grouped in with people who are nightly renting because then they just lost their primary resident exemption, which is huge. So something else to consider. There's always so many more things that go in and then just the one thing. So.
Well, we do have a public hearing on this item. So if we are finished the people for our discussion? Are we good? Then I'll open this up now to the public hearing.
I've got something. I have a basement apartment.
Come to the microphone, and you can
get 3 minutes.
Can't
yeah.
tell you're on 3 minutes.
Okay. JT Frank, 076 Canyon Heights Drive. I have a basement apartment. I've never even considered doing the Airbnb. I don't think I ever would. But if you limit how many there are going to be, who decides how many and who gets them? And does anybody deciding that own? That's a conflict of interest, and you're really opening yourself to losses.
Yeah, that's why I think it's a non-limit on the number is good.
Yeah,
and it would be, JP, it would be first come, first served. Whoever, if there were limits, whoever applies first, the first one to get those numbers in the zone.
That's all I have.
Thank you.
Okay, grandfathered into that. Kate Hugel, 3962 West 98th North Pleasant, or Cedar Grove. Just be Pleasant Grove, just be Manoa. So, one of the things that I haven't heard a lot of discussion about is we've talked about the owner occupied, but like I was saying, look at our demographics, look at how many people might be leaving the home for a year, or a year and a half, or 2 years, having somebody rent their portion from it, and then taking care of the Airbnb portion, which is what makes it possible for them to leave the home so that they can do the service they want to do. And so I would like to see that there's some kind of accommodation made there for the, I'm talking seniors, 16, 55 and above, or anyone who that decides to pass through that phase. So.
I'm sorry, I'm taking him a category.
Seniors, I know, to just ask AARP. But anyway, anybody who's planning on doing those kinds of things, then their primary residence is still the home. Like mine, that's still my primary residence, even though I'm not there for a year or a year and a half or something like that. That would still be my primary residence. So I'd like that to be taken into consideration. And about the Airbnb portion, nobody wants to be blackballed on Airbnb. So if somebody comes to my place and I didn't like the way they acted, Airbnb blocks them. They can't go anywhere else. So people who are familiar with Airbnb know that, and they do things like, I mean, some of my people even fold up all the laundry, I mean, the towels and everything, and leave everything in really nice stacks because they want me to give them a good rating. So if anybody comes into an Airbnb and is horrible, they're not going to be renting from Airbnb again.
Also,
it works
both ways. They
Yeah, so they're blackballed. They won't be renting from Airbnb again. So that means Airbnb actually has good renters because they go through a filtering system. And the other thing I was just going to say is come to my house. Come see what I do and see what the plans are and have been. And I would love for you to come by and see. Also, you're talking about the gondola and all of that. The people who are going into Airbnbs have a little bit more money than those that are staying at hotels and things. And so the people that are coming in have also end up having a little bit more respect as well for the property and neighborhood.
Cindy, thank you for that, Kay, and thank you for your comments. We already have code that prohibits renting out your home top and bottom or side to side. So the owner has to live in one portion of it. So that code is kind of carrying over to this Airbnb or, you know, nightly rental code. So if you own a home and it has a basement apartment, you can't rent out the top and the bottom.
Unless it's one family for the whole house.
Exactly.
That's
we do have some exceptions in the code, though. There are some exceptions for going away for a short amount of time. We do have that in the ADU code, or was it this code that I was reading today? We do have some that if you're going to be away for a little bit on a mission or something like that.
There are
an AD, I believe it's an ADU code, but when, so if you really need to leave your home for 3 years, you could rent it and not be there, but you just can't create a duplex. So what we've seen is a lot of people will create the ADU in hopes that they can move out, rent the ADU, and then rent the main dwelling as well as a second family, and basically create it as a duplex that they make it themselves.
So for the Airbnb, making it a duplex, then, yeah?
It would be not under occupied.
Yes, under occupied, yes, it would make it a duplex. It would make it, part of the way we're approaching this problem is that we want to see the owners take responsibility for the dwelling itself, for the issues that are coming up from the STRs.
Even if you have a responsible renter, you would be there on site.
But she could have a family, though, say she had a daughter or grandchild.
Absolutely.
You could, they could stay and if they are renting.
Yeah, that'll work.
So they could stay in the main portion of the house and still Airbnb if it's family.
The same thing we do for ADUs.
Can we adopt people?
You actually,
I said that.
I have several grandchildren you can adopt.
Yes.
Camp Rust, 3751 West Box Elder Drive. First of all, thank you so much for your willingness to serve and for the support and stuff. I appreciate that. Things that you've discussed here tonight, I'm encouraged at what I'm hearing and doing. The market does drive everything. As mentioned, the rating that happens with both our place, meaning the rental, is something that we strive. We always want 5 stars. We always want that. And same token, then we turn around and rate the guests. And I will tell you that there are some guests that I will tell them don't want to rent to them again. And so they have a rating with them. We have a book that outlines everything that they can do and not do. Hours when they can do things. I think that eliminates problems that you have. There was a question about if you have 6 people coming and staying, do you have 6 cars? I have never had more than 3 cars at my place, and most of the time, it's always less than 2. It's 2 or less, and I'm renting up to 10 people with that. Now, I could have, in fact, I've had 20 of my kids and grandkids staying in my basement. It's that large that 20 can stay there. I never want 20 people to rent that because I don't want the damage done to it, okay? So I have set a number that is appropriate for what the size of that place is, okay? That's why I think it's important, don't put a cookie cutter number on every unit because we have different sizes that people will do short-term rentals. I don't think there's anything. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about what we're doing.
I just want I have your address because my sister and her family come every summer from Florida. And when the Marys come, I have 14 people in my house for 8 weeks this summer, and it about killed me. I would love to have a place that they could rent
nearby.
Yeah, nearby. We can still be close together, but it's available. So to me, that is very enticing.
It's interesting that the people who came during the wintertime are, and this is our first year, full year doing it, everybody who came during the winter were skiers. Mm-hmm. They would come and stay and go to the ski resorts. In the spring, it's all weddings. In the summer, it's split between weddings and sightseeing. And we've had people, like I said, from all over the U.S. come in and stay.
So one thing just you might want to consider is you brought up the point, Attorney, said there may be occupancy issues with the fire and things like that, so that may be a reason to limit the amount of occupancy numbers.
Yes. But the question with that is, do you limit full? Is that limiting a household number? If I had a family and I had 10 children, okay?
Good point.
Would that limit that?
No, I don't think so.
It wouldn't.
Right.
But when there's a commercial aspect to it, it changes the.
Yeah, the, right, because you're renting that, there's commercial.
It's the same thing, I think, like a hotel. And I mentioned six cars, the.
It's for
long term rental. Right. You have six college kids all living together.
Can I say something real quick?
Of course.
And I'm here for the other issue, but this is interesting because we may find ourselves in a few years in a position to be able to rent part of our home. And just for maybe the councils and some of the people that are here, the reason for the owner living there and not turning it into a duplex is there's requirements you're needed, your fire separation of the units, different electrical services for each unit, different water, and so everything's separate. But the biggest issue is the fire separation, which you wouldn't have in the ADU ordinance that's currently adopted by the state.
Excuse me, sir, what's your name?
Oh, sorry, Donald Simons.
Okay.
3817.
Thank you.
West Valley Drive.
Laura Johnson, 13124 Street Drive. I liked what Mr. Miller said about we actually have a rental house here in Cedar Hills, our previous home. And we rented out long term. We've had renters there for about 3 years now. Wonderful family, they fit into the community great. They're have friends in the neighborhood and they're loving it. But it is something that we talked about, we heard about the gondola issue and things, and I said, I told my husband, I said, well, if that ever happens, I would love to turn that house into a short-term rental. It's a small house, it's 2,100 square feet from the 70s, it's a split level, four bedrooms. It's a smaller house, you're not gonna have, you know, just right for a family. And so I would love to have that option be open sometime, whether that's with the, you know, apply with a conditional use permit or something to that effect. Right now, we're not interested in short-term rental in that because I have little kids and I'm not looking for a second job. Because short-term rental is already a lot of work, aren't they? Because they're a lot of work. And so, but yeah, I would love to see that as an available option for Sunday. So,
All right, do you have any other comments? Okay. All right. Then we're going to close the public hearing portion of that item. And I've heard interest in tabling this item, or if anyone wants to make a motion, that we
can
make a motion.
Over the, just so we're clear on what we come back with.
Yes.
Okay. I want to hear that this would require a business license. We would redact the limits on the numbers in the community that by voting for sale. I heard that we wanted to see what rules companies have on closing short-term rental. It sounds like not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I don't know how much time I can spend on that. I'll follow up. And then we talked about the issue of renting while away. One thing you can consider if we don't say you can rent your home and then
you're limited, Janet. Your time is up.
Happily sit down. One thing you can consider is that the group living arrangement is if you needed to leave your home for 2 years, you could arrange for rent it out to four people, unrelated people, as a single housekeeping unit under our current code. So there are ways to maybe meet that end. I had mentioned that maybe removing the eight related people so there's not a limit on the number of related people that would be in the home. Councilmember Smith and I talked about the parking language, and I was going to see if I could find some better verbiage on making that a little bit more clear. And one thing we talked about, and I wanted to get some clarification on, is do we want to explore creating basically an exclusion zone similar to what St. George does, like zones in the city where you can have non-owner-occupied short-term rentals? Is that something we want to tackle this time, or are we just going to let the owner-occupied?
I think
with the direction the state's going, they're going to force our hand. They're going to have to agree with that.
Those are the changes I have.
I think that's
okay.
We appreciate the work that you
And just for the public's information. information. The first time it comes to the City Council and Planning Commission, there's this public hearing where you have the opportunity to engage with the council, or engage with the chair, probably more. But the next time it comes, there's not a public hearing. So if you have something, if you see something in the proposed code, I would recommend that you email the council or email staff with your concerns.
And you can always address the council at public hearing, public comment period.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And we would take that into that account.
Yes, thank you. Okay. I will entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion when we table item, which is 8.
Yeah.
Item number 8.
Sorry, this is 7.
No, it went to 8.
To a later time to allow staff to research and address issues.
Councilmember Miller, do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Councilmember Hedges. Councilmember Elbert.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Allison.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Councilmember Hedges.
Aye.
Okay, the motion to table this item has passed unanimously. We'll see this come again. So thank you. Thank you for everyone for your comments. We're going to move on to our new item number 9. Review action public hearing on amendments to 10-5-3 renewable energy systems related to ground mounted solar.
Okay. So, again, here in this topic, there's that dynamic at play of let me do what I want on my property versus how does it impact my neighbors. So, keep that in mind. That was really the crux of the discussions this past through the planning commission. Ground mounted solar energy systems, we originally talked about possibly not allowing them. That they can be, they honestly can be so obtuse in the neighborhood that we thought maybe we should propose not allowing it. Planning Commission didn't really take that approach, so they worked on drafting code that allowed them, but with some severe limitations, that the ground mounted solar has to be at least 10 feet from any property line, thereby pulling it away from those who are impacted by it. It limited the height of the ground mounted solar system from 20 feet, which is the height of an accessory structure, and calling out specifically for ground mounted solar that it could be no longer no higher than 6 feet. The reason 6 feet is that you can cover with a fence in Seattle, I suppose. In the code, the proposed code, there is an administrative conditional use approval for the applicants can demonstrate that the ground support that would allow them to go higher when the applicant can demonstrate that their system would not have a visual impact on the surrounding property. And that the project would not be above the top of the project, solar panels would not be above the top of the ridge line of the home, if you can imagine that. Because everyone in the City Hills does not live in a flat, nice lot. Some of us live on hillsides where the backyard is much higher than the home itself. And then we're limiting ground mounted solar to be on lots that are greater than 11,000 square feet. So we're saying that, well, we're recognizing you can do this throughout the community, you cannot do it everywhere. We don't want to see ground mounted solar placed within any easement or right of way or stormwater drainage basin or area. And then we wanted to carve out some exceptions for small decorative systems that obviously are not an issue with ground solar, where you have a little solar panel light sticking to the ground. You can imagine that. I'm sure you've all seen the Home Depot. And then, as I mentioned in the work session, the city has a couple solar panels on some of the public utility infrastructure in order to generate power for some of our systems. So we would want to make sure that those are still allowed. So with that being said, I'm going to have a great discussion about this in the council meeting. I'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, concerns when we do a public hearing on this item.
So I mentioned in the work session that I would like specific language on the exception. I feel like there's no code at all if we don't have specific things that you can do if you want an exception. So because then everybody could just get an exception. So I'd like more specific language on perhaps how big the home is, you know, if you need a bigger one because your home's larger, to be able to generate whatever you're trying to do. If you live on a bigger lot, if you live a little bit away from everybody else, if you've got another way to, you know, cover up the solar panels, or, you know, the use of other homeowners. So I would like more specific language on what those exceptions would be, so it's not just you and the homeowner coming to the room. Besides that, looks good to me. Does anyone else have any questions or comments on the code that's written here?
I agree those changes would probably involve a lot of things.
So do we then discuss the size of lots? I mean, we've got to be specific if we're going to make code for it. We talked earlier in work session about...
It said 11,000.
11,000 is for...
11,000 square feet is...
The minimum for...
Minimum amount of square footage required to be able to have the system.
If you want something
more, to have a ground mounted system?
Ground, have a ground mounted system. Ground. Ground.
Ground. Ground. It should be 10,000 because 10,000 is sort of a nominal quarter acre, but.
Yeah, but
I'm
not going
to make minimum just to install. Now,
looking at, I have no idea. Like, you have to look at the lot.
Yeah, so that's what it is, right? 10,000 is quarter acre. 1,000
Do we call it an R10 or what do we call it?
R111.
So, I mean, it's, I live in R111 and my lot is exactly 10,000 square feet. It's 100 by 100. That's a quarter acre. A nominal quarter acre, obviously, 43,560 is the actual square footage of an acre. But.
I think it would be simple to do it by zone, like we do for large animals, like we do for splitting your property. Something where you've got a sizable
amount. Yeah, I'm okay with that. Doing it in the R11 zone, whatever we call it. I can't remember.
So, I mean, you could go, I recognize
no smaller
zones are the same. You have, PR 2.2, you have really dense zones, which would be a PD1 zone. If anyone down there tried to do a ground mounted solar, I'm unaware. But those are lots of 4,000 or 5,000 square feet.
Right.
So they're very small. But you have large properties up in the R120,000 and the R115,000 where you have a third to a half acre. So you have a great deal of land there, so treat them all the same. I think that's what the Planning Commission is recognizing, that the impact in the R120,000 is not going to be the same as the impact in the R119,000. So
I'd be happy to keep it under nothing under the R111 zone.
But we're saying that everything over R111 can have it, then we're also saying everyone can apply for an exception. That's what I don't want.
But I don't see this as being, I think we're overthinking it. I think there's going to be so few ground-mounted solars. I think we're spending too much time on something that doesn't need to be talked about.
I agree, but when they come, they can
be obtrusive
and mighty nasty.
What are the other parameters we have to look at? How to define the impact on
the visual impact on the surrounding area. That one.
But that's
that
the condition. That's the condition.
Yeah, that's. I think that's Councilor Smith's point, is that you're saying, well, what is the minimum visual impact? What is, how do you define it? And that one's going to be a little more challenging.
One person's minimal, if they want it, is different than my minimal, if it's in my backyard, but I don't want it.
Yeah, it's only 25% of your view.
Yeah, it's no different than if someone is allowed to build a detached garage 1 foot from their property line at a certain square footage. I don't know, like 120 square feet or something like that. And it has to be no higher than a certain height. I mean, that's the visual.
But that's the compromise, so we don't let people say, unless you don't like it, and then we'll let you do an exception. So I don't care if we have code, but we've got to have code. And for the exception, there also has to be code.
The exception has to go through a whole different process.
I lean towards us having no exceptions.
So you can say there's not going to be an exception, that it can't be higher than 6 feet from the property line.
I'm fine.
If there's a property line, at that point it can't be higher than 6 feet.
Yeah.
That would be blocked by a fence.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that solves the problems to pull up. And when I was just going out with the code again, do we have a limit to the number? You have 18, 6 foot.
So 50% of the back of the yard.
Okay. Okay. Does that satisfy the issue if we pull out the exception? It does for me. Anyone want to feel good about that? Okay. We have a public hearing on this item. So if there's anyone here who would like to speak to this item of ground mounted solar. Mayor, I just wanted to mention, because we do have such a good group here. Just so you kind of know,
where we're all at. Like on this issue, I would love to be a hard, fast no. But I'm not going to be a hard, fast no just because that's my opinion, right? So I listen to other people and I try and come up with, you know, what also gives other people property rights. And so just so you know, sometimes when we vote, it's not really how we feel personally, but it's how we've looked at the issue, it's turned it around and talked to a ton of people. And so I don't get to always just do whatever I want to do. On this, if I were to be honest, I'd just be no solar panels at all. So just, I just want people to understand that sometimes you see our votes and you think, oh, that's their opinion. It's not always. It's not always. We're trying to listen to all the residents and come up with something that my vote counts for a lot of people and not just what the other person wants. So I, and I think I can speak for everybody out here that that's true. I don't know that people watch us enough to know that how hard we work on it, but I just wanted to mention that. When you hear my vote, I in a perfect world, I can say no. But I'm not going to.
I would say no too, but I don't care about this, so.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, with that being said, I will entertain a motion on this item. And this is
B,
since we can table the other one. So.
I'll go ahead and make the motion to approve ordinance 9-14-2021B, amending Cedar Hills City Code Title 10. Section 5, Chapter 38, Renewable Energy Systems related to ground mounted solar, subject to the following changes. We're going to pull out the executive session.
Thank you, Councilmember Elsworth. Do I have a second? I'll second. Thank you, Councilmember Smith. Councilmember Elsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Dillner.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellison.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Thank you. That passes unanimously. We'll move on to item number 9. Okay, our discussion on an ordinance amending Cedar Hills City Code Title 5, Chapter 2, related to parking trailers and recreational vehicles in a public right of way. And I will mention that this is not an item that we're voting on tonight. It's only a discussion because so much discussion happened after we passed the last ordinance that we thought this was a good time to talk about it, flesh it out, see what's going to work. We've got a lot of input, we had a lot of good visits with residents. And so tonight we said we'd come back and revisit this ordinance that was recently passed. There is no public hearing on this.
There's no public hearing, but you know, okay, I want to read this comment that we'd like to read in public comment period.
Yes.
This is from a resident, Keith Irwin. He lives in the city, I don't remember this.
Somewhere over there.
But he shared, if you want to read this in the record, Mayor Gaskin did the same, but it's just going to go back. He said, I had a productive meeting with Mayor Kelly to discuss the impact of recent changes to the parking ordinance regarding recreation vehicles. Since I will be out of town during the council meeting, I would like to summarize my points for all of you. In my experience, appropriate safety measures are always an issue to be gritty. Jokes about OSHA regulations are a prime example of what happens when they become excessive and result in unintended consequences. When it comes to parking, for example, we could ban parking of everything to open up sight lines, but all of us would agree that that would create an excessive burden on vehicle owners. I know that assessing the risk and burden is a balancing act. I'm sure that's what you're trying to do. The former code included that parking of any vehicles for more than 48 hours. The council reduced this to 24 hours. The question is, how much additional safety is gained by eliminating the additional day of parking for these new vehicles? A few times they are on the street. I'd argue not much. While it does add significant burden on those of us who use boats, trailers, RVs, and the like, nearly all boats and RVs that park on city streets come from storage locations and are parked for a day or two to unload, load, clean, and maintain them. They are then moved back to storage or off on a trip. Moving the time frame back to 40 hours is a more reasonable time to accomplish these tasks. The frequency of these types of vehicles on the streets is not like utility trailers or trucks that are used for work or parked on city streets on a daily basis. I urge the council to rescind the changes made to Code 5-2-5 Parking 1.2 so the time frame for parking remains 48 hours for all vehicles. Reviewing the code, I found another change I would suggest. D-4. Regarding oversized vehicles, defines them as anything over 25 feet. That may have worked 25 years ago when boats and trailers were smaller. Today's boats and RVs are substantially longer, though no wider. I suggest the council update this length to 40 feet to acknowledge the reality of changed sizes of recreation boats, trailers, and motor homes. In consideration of the willingness to revisit this issue, I'd appreciate if this could be read during the public comment period at Tuesday's council meeting. Yeah, so we're all doing great things tonight. So, again, I appreciate everyone being here and sitting through this meeting.
the question came up of, and I've heard this before, was when people get a parking violation, their issue,
right,
is that a lot of people feel like they're being targeted, that it's just them. And so I had staff, or Mayor, since you had staff, and I told them I wanted to look, but we had staff take a peek at the parking violations that occur in the community over the past 4 years, showing that this is all over. And rather than putting a dot on the map and calling out people directly, we decided to use that voting precinct map for some good. And we broke down by voting precinct how many but how many parking violations for cars and how many parking violations there were for recreational vehicles over the course of the last 4 years. And I'd have to go look at some of the story here in history, because it fluctuates quite a bit, but I think I know some of the answers and some of them I've had to do some research on. But let's start with the cereals for precincts. You can see the number of cars that were tagged each year, and you can see the number of recreational vehicles. By far the bigger problem is cars. It is cars. Excuse me. And you might ask yourself, why does it jump up so high in 2019 versus, like, this Cedar Hills was two? Why is 2019 so high, so much higher than 2020? Like, you can see it here too, 58 to 14, 26 to 2, 33 to 8. Why does that fluctuate so greatly? And the only thing I can come up with is that 2019 was a much wetter winter than 2020, and so a lot more people got sighted parking on the street in the wintertime. Their cars. And then also something to keep in mind is that Jenny Pay, our code enforcement official, who I will tell you does a fantastic job. She has an impossible job. I've told this joke before, but I mean every time she leaves the building, I say, Jenny, you're going out to make some friends today. But she does a great job, and I think that the code enforcement is essential to maintaining the integrity of the community. And so with that, you have, as a legislative body, you have the ability to say, here's what we want our community to look like. And that's why we talk about parking. This is, someone said on Facebook, I was told that, you know, why is the city even talking about this? Don't we have anything better to do? This is what the city does. This is in our wheelhouse. I spent more time talking about cat houses on the road, unfortunately. But this is like a prime example of something that affects cities. Right. You can see that it's throughout the community, it's throughout the city that we have these parking issues. So it does become, and not in everything, not every time that someone puts a trailer or a boat or an RV on a road does it become a safety issue, but it very well can. Mayor, I know you have some anecdotal data that you'd like to share, but whenever an RV is parked, you know, blocking somebody's ability to pull out of their garage and see what's coming down the road, that's a problem. When it's parked in a way on a corner that prohibits people from seeing around that corner, that's a problem. So the reason it's a safety issue where cars typically aren't is you can usually see around cars, but if you have a big RV, they can be more challenging to see around. So you can be caught off guard. I think that's one of the big issues. And let me talk about enforcement a little bit, because unfortunately I don't have a timer on every city, so when somebody pulls up their RV and parks in front of their house, that clock just starts ticking. It doesn't work like that. It's usually what happens.
You send out the drone though, don't you?
I send out the drone.
The city drone, it goes around and it starts timing everybody. I just want everybody to know that we have a few of those. So that's
stop it, Mike.
Spraying chemtrails, right? No, but usually this is what happens, is person A parks their RV on the street, neighbor sees it, ignores it, 3 days go by, nothing happens, it doesn't move, 4 days go by, they start getting irritated, day four or five, they call the city saying, hey, this person has parked their RV in front of the city, in their house, and it is really, really annoying. Day five, we send out code enforcement. Well, like I said, I don't know that it's been there for 5 days. I don't just take the neighbor's word for it. So we'll take a picture of it and put the tag and watch it. And in 48 hours, we send them a notice. But that 48 hours, we could be 5, 6, 7 days into this park, into this RV being parked on the street. And so they have, you know, a day to move it. So that RV could have been there for 8 days before that 48 hours is up. That's just the nature of code enforcement. So,
I'm just trying to understand. So a lot of people were asking about that because, so what if they took it, as he had mentioned, to get work done, it was gone for half a day or, and then he's coming back.
Oh, but essentially, it's hard to enforce. Really is hard to enforce. But I do feel that if you're going to have the RV, the trailer, you need to have somewhere off the street to park it. For the long term. So I just want you to be aware of the challenge of enforcement on this, is that it, by the time the city's stepping in to get involved in an issue, by and large, they've been there much longer than 48 hours. And so by the time the city's 48-hour clock is up, it's been there quite some time. And so that's why I think the 24-hour came into play, is that it shortens that window. It allows the city to kind of take care of some of these issues a little quicker.
Can I just say one other thing about Jenny? Because I just want to tell you, she's a fantastic employee.
She is.
And she has a thankless job, but she's no respecter of persons. She's notified me several times for violations, and I gladly take her violation and try to correct it. She's not, you know, she's out there, a thankless job. She leaves the office. She has no friends. People call her and yell at her and all sorts of say nasty stuff to her. But she doesn't deserve it. And I'm just saying, the city, her job isn't to go out and to write tickets. She's really responding, to complaints. She's not really, we don't go around the city looking for a trailer that's been parked there and put a mark on the street and then come back at it 24 hours later hoping to give it a ticket. That is not what we do. And I there's been a lot of kind of insinuations that the city's out just looking for people that are in violation. I don't think that is the case.
There's not. So if you look at our budget, there's a line item that shows where we collect zoning violations. We collect $0. There's no amount of general fund that is reliant on a quota of violations to be issued throughout the city. Most of the time, we really try to work things out before it gets to a violation.
And my final comment on that was, this ordinance was really about being good neighbors, not the city being a gazebo, okay? That's what this whole ordinance is about.
So, I mean, as I think about why you see kind of the big discrepancies between this pink voting precinct and this purple voting precinct, is something that comes to mind, is especially on the cars up here, is that when, two things, is when there's a snow plow out, a car up here will prevent a snow plow from getting by.
Absolutely.
Right? Whereas up here, a car parked on the side of the street is, we can still usually get a snow plow by, but sometimes you still tag them. Two is the streets right here are just very narrow. And so the cars park up there very long period of time, or they're already whatever. It really does create a bottleneck or a nuisance for two cars trying to pass where that trailer or RV is. So we would get more complaints up there at Cedar Hills 3 versus some of these other areas of the city, just due to the right of way there.
So the other point might be, that's also the HOA. And so,
but we don't enforce that.
The HOA is
on this side. So we don't enforce any parking in the
street. Oh, so really those numbers are really just the pure east side.
Just that portion.
That's what I thought originally, but then you were pointing in that area.
I'm sorry, I was pointing the whole voting district, but it is just...
Yeah, there's no HOA on the east side. So all those numbers reflect
east. When the snow comes down, this is generally the first area that we have to go plow. Those are steep roads, they're narrow, and the cars are in the way,
yeah.
We got a problem. So this isn't just a discussion item, but I recognize that there's a lot of people here that have voiced their opinions, and I know the council even listened to that. I'd love to get some feedback on how we return to this. And then I have a question for Hiram in terms of process on this. Normally with the land use, we have the planning commission take a crack at it and then they make a recommendation to the council. If council were to decide to rescind it, does that have to go to the planning commission again?
As long as it's...
Okay, no, never mind. It's Title 5, not Title 10.
Yeah, I was going to say first, I don't think it's Title 10, but it's...
You're right, yeah.
Second question, as long as it's gone to the planning commission once.
So, I'll just give my two cents. The code, just so everybody knows, was we heard that there were a lot of calls, and so that's what kind of triggered it. And then it was, how do we make this as safe as possible? And so I think where we got off the mark was that we thought it took 24 hours to load a trailer and get it ready, and then apparently it took 48. But what I was seeing online was not just going back to the 48, but was no regulation at all. And so I'm kind of stuck now between people didn't even seem to realize it was 48 hours, and then people don't want us to regulate it at all, which I don't think that we can do. You know, people will say, well, it's a public road. I get that, but it's also my public road. So your right to park your trailer interferes with my right to see the street and to see driveways and to be able to turn right and that sort of thing. So I think that's what we're battling against, is the safety and the visibility that everybody can do, and then allowing people to bring their trailers home and get them fixed and get them ready or bring their boats home. And then, you know, I kind of struggle with Mr. Applington's, you know, situation where, you know, he needs it for work. Which I sympathize with, but then also how do we still create visibility? And I've seen some that honestly, if they were just parked differently than they were parked, you could see. If they weren't right at the stop sign, if they weren't right where you could see, could they be closer to your driveway, where at least you're the one who can't see when you come out of your driveway. So if you can't see and you're the one that gets hit by a car, you know, you parked your RV there. So if we can find ways, what I noticed on Facebook that concerned me a little was a lack of concern for the community, which is our job, right? So we don't get to just say we don't care about the community. And so what I'd like to see from people who have RVs and have trailers is that sense of community too, not that I have a trailer and I want to park it and not, you know, the hell with everybody else. You know, I'd like to see that same kind of give and take, and I think if we could do that, we could get to something that everybody could live with. So I loved the engagement. I loved hearing from everybody. We've learned that we'd like to hear that before instead of after, but it doesn't hurt. And hopefully you've learned that our codes are fluid and that we can change them if we get good feedback from residents. And hopefully you've also learned that we want to be good neighbors too. Like, these codes are our codes. We have to go home and live by these same codes. So we want to hear what you have to say, and we want to come up with something that doesn't make everybody happy, because that's never going to happen. Hopefully a good code to me, everybody's a little unhappy after it's over, right? Everybody's done a little bit of give and a little bit of take so that we can live together in a community. So that's where I was coming from, always from a safety issue, never about an annoyance issue. I don't have an issue in my neighborhood. I don't have an RV. I don't have a dog in the fight, except that I want our roads to be safe for children and for cars. So if I have an agenda, that would be my agenda is safety, but I don't not care about people who need to park their vehicles, get them ready for work or those sorts of things. So
based on the Facebook conversation, I think we did pull some good numbers. There, it seemed like the common thread was it took about 72 hours to prep an RV sufficiently to go. I would be happy to put, you know, move the time from 24 to 72 hours rather than 48. You know, it's, if I look at how it's been done in my neighborhood, that's kind of a trend. You know, it's usually, you know, 48 hours plus 12, and then they leave. So whatever, 72. The other thing I would love to see is if we could figure a way for people who do have occupation-related trailer. Is there anything we can do to facilitate, you know, either guidance on where they can put it safely so we don't have to worry about it? I don't know. But that seems to me to be a tough spot that needs to be addressed outside of people parking an empty trailer on the street for no reason other than they didn't find it in their driveway.
So that brings me to my point. That some of the comments on Facebook were that there was an agenda with the city council for this for whatever reason. And if there is an agenda, I will fully admit that my agenda number one is safety. That's
that's my agenda. To make our streets more safe, we have a situation in our neighborhood where sometimes there's two box trailers parked on either side of the road, and two cars cannot pass by, and it happens frequently. That's a safety issue. I shared with Mr. Goodwin an incident that happened in Cedar Hills. This is not outside of our neighborhood. This is in Cedar Hills when we lived on Oak Road. There was a trailer, and it was a flatbed trailer that was frequently parked on Oak Road West. And I don't know that anyone complained about it, but it was there all the time. And there was room in the driveway to park it, but they didn't want to park in the driveway. It was parked on the street. Well, on June 10th, 2005, this little boy, Ammon Banta, got in his brother's go-kart and headed down Oak Road West and veered off to the left and ran into that trailer and was killed. So when you say it's not a safety issue, it is a safety issue. I, myself, have driven down my road and a kid on a bike or on a scooter will pop out from behind a trailer and it's a close call. And I've seen it happen with other cars as well. So when you're parking something on the street that obstructs visibility, it's an issue, it's a safety issue. I don't want to have another Ammon Banta. This little boy was in my primary. It was the saddest funeral I've ever been to. He shouldn't have died on June 10th because that trailer was on the street. There was no trailer there. He would have hit the curb, flew up in the air probably, and landed on the front yard of that house because that's where the trailer was kept, right in the front yard. I don't know. That's my prediction of what would have happened. But for me, it is a safety issue. It's a nuisance issue to the neighbors who always have the trailers out or whatever the issue is. It's number one for me, a safety issue. I don't want to see this happen again. And you could say, well, that was 16 years ago, but it's a reality. And so if we can prevent this, you know, we can't keep all of the vehicles off the road, but there has to be an ordinance that controls it in some way, and there has to be a willingness of the residents to comply, keep our neighborhood nuisance-free, and, like you said, be good neighbors.
Thank you, Mayor, for your head.
Thank you.
I must apologize if you have to go.
Okay.
Is there going to be a public discussion about this? Something you'd like to bring something up?
It's going to come back. This is going to have a new ordinance, and so you'll be able to make a public comment at the beginning, and then we'll have some.
I agree with you with the safety stuff, but the only difference between my van and my neighbor's suburban being parked on the street is mine says pole plumbing on the side.
Okay. So it's just a discussion. If there's anything else anybody would like to add.
Well, that's my question is, so 24 was not good. 48 had been good, but not probably going to be enforced. So I'm just wondering what people want. Do they want 72? Do they want nothing? Do they, you know what I mean? I just got to kind of figure out.
Nothing's not going to work.
Right.
Councilmember Smith and I had a great discussion with Pete Irwin, who is in the letter. He's an RV owner. He can't, all that's where he is right now. That's why he's not here. He takes his RV out all the time. He told us that 48 hours for him seemed like a sufficient amount of time to turn around his RV, to get the refrigerator cold, to do the things that needed to happen. That he felt like 48 hours was sufficient. But,
I'm on the 48-hour line. I think that's plenty of time to get your trailer in. 48 hours, stock it up, right? Come home. 48 hours after your month-long summer vacation. I don't think you need longer than 48 hours, personally.
Okay.
I mean, I was fine with 24, but I understand. I don't have an RV. I don't vote, but I keep it on track.
After hearing the comments, I don't have a problem moving it back to the 48. I think it's a balance. Can enforce that. As I wrote in the council corner message or whatever in the newsletter that went out this month's utility bill, nothing of you here is set in stone. We will always consider new information, new perspectives, and we can revisit things. We prefer to get it right the first time and hear from the public prior. Nothing. We're always willing to hear new perspectives and receive new information.
Okay.
Yes.
To make a comment?
Yes.
In a different direction than what the discussion has been, but related, our city code 524 addresses truck routes, limits vehicles to 1.5 tons or less beyond the public streets. And I just recognize we have a lot of motorhomes parked on streets and using the streets that are over that.
Yeah.
Boats, trailers. I'm just wondering if that's something that should be part of the topic.
Yeah. So besides the length that Mr. Irwin mentioned, we also need to look.
That's what brought it to my attention when he said, yeah, we got, you know, 40-footers now. Well, we also have a lot heavier.
Okay. I think that goes along with what Jeff was saying, too, is that we need to be careful, and maybe we should add this to the code, but we enforce line of sight corners, okay? Every corner has a line of sight. And even though it's not marked or painted red or whatever, there's a hypothetical line when you're turning a corner that you have to, if you're doing, you know, your house or your front fence, all have to be within this line of sight line. And it really should extend all the way back to, I mean, you can park right next to the, on my street, for instance, I have a stop sign at the end of my street. You can park right, legally, there's, it's not red or anything, but now you're blocking the line of sight. Our legal code enforced line of sight, right?
Correct, yes.
So I think that maybe should be added to the...
There's also the line of sight as your driveway. You have to maintain a line of sight out of the driveway, so... Yes.
I wanted to talk a little bit about enforcement of this. Part of the reason that we addressed the code and changed it 24 hours is because it wasn't being enforced by the, you know, if we changed it, people would be more diligent about turning it over fast enough. But we talked about Jenny before and the excellent job that she does. And Jenny is a one-woman show, and she has a lot to do, and she currently is on 32 hours a week, and I would be happy if we could move her up to 40 hours a week. I understand that she'd be amenable to that idea, and if we could find that in the budget to move Jenny up, because she really is overworked, and it might help in enforcement if she had more hours in a week to do her job. So something to think about.
What we'll do is I'll get with Charlotte and talk about what that would look like as part of the budget adjustment before I line up to the GPs or visit it. Part of the reason that she's not so much going on is that when I was the assistant city manager for the city, Dave Bunker, I was the assistant city manager / city planner, and when Dave Bunker left and I took over the city manager, I retained the city planner position. We didn't hire a new assistant city manager. So Jenny has been helping out a lot with many of the planning functions that I just don't have time to get to. Unless people want to wait for months for a building permit or a home permit, which I don't think they'd be an objective, right? No. So she's been taking on that role as well. So there's enough work to do. So I'll get to Charlotte and we'll look at those numbers a little bit.
I mean, maybe it's time to even, I mean, maybe that could be handled by a part-time person as well. Something like that. I agree, Jenny looks at every building permit, I believe, sure, for zoning and planning.
Yeah.
Talk
about the budget. It's too soon. Give me 6 months.
I didn't make eye contact with you when I brought that up.
There's a lot of inflation in a lot of areas right now.
We'll talk internally and see what we can come up with.
Okay. Does anyone have anything else about this parking ordinance? If not, then we'll move on to our next item, which is the discussion on city water system and use issues.
Yeah. I will say this. I think that of everything that you're talking about tonight, I think that this item is the most important thing. Without a doubt. You talked about essential city services that the city provides. We all care about parking and Airbnbs, but if the water stops flowing, you really don't hear about it. So,
this right here, and I apologize, this chart's hastily made, I just put it here before this, I wanted to show you this, but the dates. Let's look at this one. So this is, here we go. All right. This is our aggregate usage throughout the year, year over year. And this dark blue line down in the middle, this is 2021. And this actually needs to shift over a little bit because we delayed the onset of the water season by a few weeks, and we're shutting it off. I'm proposing shutting it off at least a week earlier. But what I wanted to do is we talked a lot about the impact that drought would have on city resources. We talked about our limited resources. So specifically we get 710 CUP water, the Central Utah Project water. That we pull out of two turnouts that are in the city to feed our PI system. Well, in years past, we used a lot of water, and this year we were relegated back to 555 acre feet. And so we're on a tighter budget for the CUP. We also have three sources we have three wells. We have the Canyon Well, which is exclusively pressurized irrigation water. We have culinary wells that are Cottonwood and Hardy. And then we can pull water out of the AF Booster. So we have a few water sources, and then we have the Pleasant Grove Irrigation Ditch. If you remember a few months ago, we showed you the sources of the water that we would be using over the year, and quite frankly, we've done pretty well this year in terms of usage. You can see that in years past, you have this royal blue line, where it's this one, the lime green line. Those ones are the heaviest years that we've used. This light Carolina blue was the lightest year, and then we're kind of somewhere in the middle this year. So we're not our highest year, we're not our lowest year. And the reason that Carolina Blue, this is 2019, the reason that this is so much less is because you remember this is when we started building Harden Park. And it had like rains every day for months, it seemed like. So people delayed turning on their water system. But once it got to the summer heat, you can see that this slope of this line is very much in line with the slope of every other year. They just almost delayed the water system just by the weather. It's been pretty wet the last little bit, so you see a little bit of dip in this year. But what we're seeing is, so we've cut back, we've had golf course cut back, we've asked the residents to cut back, we've implemented smart meter policies where smart controller policies where if you have one of these smart controllers on your irrigation system, you can get an exemption from the day restriction that's since 2015. But what we've seen is that our system is highly vulnerable in the case that one of our wells goes down. In fact, in 2017-2018, Cottonwood Well, which is our highest producing well for culinary water, was down almost the entirety of both of those years while we worked out issues with the motor and the drive, the VFD guy.
Yeah, 14 months. So.
It was a long time. It was a critical moment we needed it, but we didn't have it. So we were in a tight squeeze there to be able to deliver water to the city. The ability to deliver water to the city then relied heavily on the Hardy Well, which is down in Heritage Park. It's that building on the south end of Heritage Park, which you might see, like, what's this all about? It's a well house. We inherited Hardy Well in 1999. That well was built in 1961 and was originally an irrigation well for the farmers that were out here at that time, and the city converted it to a culinary well. But what we've seen is that PJ did this great image, and I love it, so I'm going to show it to you. This is a diagram of the Harvey Well. I apologize, that's very difficult to see, but I'll zoom in. So up here at the very top of the building, this 300 horsepower motor that turns this well, and the well goes down into the water table and pulls up the water into the system. In 1999, the water was 435 feet below ground level. And since 1999 to 2021, we estimate we've lost up to 73 feet of the water table, which puts us to where we are today. We are at 362 feet below ground level. At 387 feet, so another 15 feet down, we start pumping air into the system, and the well has to be shut down permanently. So we are mighty close to the point when this well does not want to work anymore. In order to meet our production requirements for peak day event, we have to produce 1,150 gallons per minute. At the current rate of what Harvey can produce, it is at 350 gallons per minute. So the difference there has to be made up by the either upbringing the water from the AF booster or bringing the water from the using the Cottonwood well. And Cottonwood well has a production ability of, I believe, up to 1,300 GPM. 1,350 GPM. The AF booster was originally supposed to be a trade with American Fork. We provide water for Lone Peak. In return, we're able to pull a little bit of water, a matching amount of water from the AF booster into our city. But over time, there's been an imbalance in that trade. We pull more than we give. So we're heavily reliant on AF booster. I'm gonna have a conversation with American Fork tomorrow about some possibilities of maybe securing that water source a little bit better. I have TJ asking, he's one of our public works guys. He's our operations manager, and he's just fantastic. If you have a question about the water system, this guy knows it. He knows it. He's amazing. But he wrote this up, and I'd like to read it. He says, on September 7th, Harvey well production reached a low of 350 gallons per minute. Per our water model, we need 483 gallons per minute average and 1,150 GPM of peak day demand. It's dropped way below efficiency and was shut down, so the Harvey well right now is not running. It was shut down for cost and maintenance precautions. AF booster has been back up to sustain peak day demands, as I mentioned, we use AF booster, but it is now maintaining all culinary production. Cottonwood well has been solely on PI to help reduce the CUP consumption. So this is a balancing act that the Public Works Department has to play from April 15th to October 15th. We have the Cottonwood well, which can produce 1,350 gallons per minute, but the demand that we have on the pump pressurized irrigation system is such that there are times when that is pumping and it is going straight to PI. It is not going to culinary, so we have to rely on Harvey well for that. Now that the Harvey well is at such a level that we're looking at this saying, how long is this water table sustainable? We're shutting down Harvey well and saying, Cottonwood, you've got to be completely reliant upon meet our city's culinary water demands, and we're pumping in water from AF booster, and we're using our CUP water. We have, like I said, this year we have 555 acre feet of CUP water. A few weeks ago, the San Francisco Water Project, they approached the city and said, are you interested in buying a temporary allotment of a few, some more acres? We jumped the chance. So we purchased 100 acre feet of water. It's not cheap. It's, what was it,
$30,000?
It's $30,000.
Well,
then,
delivery
fees.
$40,000.
It's
a lot of money.
I'm pretty sure it was $22,700.
Okay. But essentially what we're doing is we're trying to buy this 180 foot block of water so that, because I don't know what the winter's going to look like this year, right? So I'm taking that 100 acre feet of water and I'm not using it this year. I'm setting it aside in a way that allows us to use, rather than the 710 that we normally get, it helps us bump that up so that we get some more water reserved for us next year, in the event that we don't have a wet winter. But if going back to this letter, it says our average demand is 5 acre feet a day of CUP, and this is at the peak of the summer. So we have 710, this year we're downgraded to 555. So you can say, okay, what's 7 times 5? That's 35. We're using 35 acre feet a week. That gives us, you can kind of start to do the math on how long is it. There's a demand curve. We don't turn the CUP on immediately in season because we rely on the ditch water. And then when the ditch water starts to wear off, taper off, we start pumping in the CUP water.
Chandler?
Yes.
Historically, though, we've used 7 acre feet a day. We've offset that this year by using Cottonwood well to give us irrigation water.
Yes. Thank you. So he said, he goes on to say, with the current condition of the Harvey well, it gains about 10 feet historically over the winter months in regeneration of the aquifer. In hopes that it continues this trend, he says, I'd like to have Harvey Grove maintain production for culinary for the months of April, May, and June, and use Cotton Grove to support PI interviews during those months. And in July, turn on the CFP and switch Cotton Grove to culinary and rely on our saved CFP to maintain the PI system, and not rely on AF1 to maintain culinary usage. So when we turn this well back on, and hopefully it's not until March or April,
yeah,
that this static water level has rebounded somewhat. It's not going to go up. This up to here, we're hoping just for an uptick, but up to here. But we recognize that there's this problem, that we have an older well, it's not a very deep well, and we're seeing that year over year, the regeneration of the aquifer, it's like a managing a bouncy ball. It just, first bounce comes up, and then slowly dissipates over time. That's what's happening as well. As a staff, we recognize that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, not addressed in the long term, but addressed in the short term. So we went ahead and contracted with a local engineering company, Hanson L. Lewis. Many of you may know Richard Noble. He was, but he was at Cedar Hills, and he's one of the engineers which we met with Mr. Noble and talked to him about our situation, understanding that out of anybody that would probably have a vested interest in maintaining Cedar Hills water production, this man probably would. He's been very generous to us. So we put together a proposal that would help us to develop a capital improvements plan. And capital improvements plan is critical because we recognize that we have a production issue. And we have a production issue of a mild nature right now, but it has the potential to become a production issue of a huge issue in a matter of moments if a well goes down. So right now we're okay, but if Cotton Well does what it did in 2017, we've got a major problem. But we also recognize that we also have a storage, a capacity problem, in that we have multiple zones in the city, and we have two tanks. We have a water tank up on the hillside up above Cedars East development, and we have a water tank on the south end of town up near the Canyon Heights development. And combined, those two water tanks hold 2.5 million gallons. Well, based on our required amount of gallons that we're supposed to reserve for firefighting purposes, it's 1.25 million gallons. So it's almost half of those tanks need to be reserved for firefighting purposes. And in the case that we have something that really needs some attention to public safety. But it's not that simple still, in that both of those zones need different amounts of residents. And those tanks are different sizes. So I can't just say, okay, well, this tank is going to be reserved exclusively for fire, and everything else is going to be for public consumption. It doesn't work like that. I have to maintain a certain amount of storage in the lower tank, and I have to maintain a certain amount of storage in the upper tank in order to make sure that we have protection throughout the whole city. But we recognize that we may have a deficiency here. And so there's an ability, there's a desire that we need to explore the possibility of a third tank in the city, third culinary tank, size probably between 500,000 to 1 million gallons. So there's these two problems. There's a production problem and a storage problem that we're grappling with. In addition to that, what's more? But in addition to that, if you watch the state legislature every year, it gets closer and closer to requiring cities to meter secondary water. Now, if we want to reduce the demand on the Cottonwood Well, on the Harvey Well, reduce the daily demand from CUP and ditch water, meter. I know it's an unpopular thing, I really do. But where we live in a drought, where we live in a desert, and we're going through an exceptional drought, one way to alleviate some of the production problem is to reduce the demand that we have for producing water, and that is to meter. Typically, when they meter, in many cases, they find that the demand for PI goes down to about 30% of what it was. So people realize that they're using way too much water. So we've seen a cutback in, I showed you, we've seen a cutback in the amount of water that we're using this year, but that's still way higher than what we need to be using. So this Hanson L. Lewis study, we go through that with you, just what what we're going to come back to you with, so that you can be informed about what we need, where we need to go from this, is they're going to be, they're going to go through our GIS, our mapping, our general plan, our water use data. They're going to take all of this data and they're going to kind of build a model for us. We're going to look at our land use and growth plan. We're going to look at our drinking water model, and they're going to evaluate the existing system. And then they're going to be giving them some well data, and they're going to look at our wells and say, okay, we recognize the same problem that you recognize. And then we're going to, the outputs that we're asking for is an updated master plan on the culinary system. And then we want to see a capital improvements plan for the master, for the culinary water system. The reason that's important is that with the American Rescue Plan Act that was passed by the federal government, the city of Cedar Hills has been allocated at least $1.1 million to use for a qualifying project. Well, a culinary water system is a qualifying project. So the question that staff has is, which issue should we tackle first? Is it storage or is it production? And so we're in the middle of evaluating that. The follow-up to this would be, once we have an idea of what needs to happen and when it needs to happen, it's a matter of securing funding. And so it's a matter of looking at the money that we have in reserve. We have about $1.8 million in the water and sewer fund that we can move towards one of these projects. And with the money that we received via ARPA, we have, we're looking at 2.9. But if we were to build even just a tank, a million-gallon tank, we'd wipe out the entirety of that savings. In addition, if we were to build a well, the question then becomes, are we replacing Harvey Well, or are we going to continue using Harvey Well and build a new well, so that there would be a third culinary well somewhere in the city? There's different processes that you have to go through the state engineer in terms of applying for that. So that we're in different time frames of when that can happen. You're looking at 2 to 3 years out. It's not something that happens and start digging and create the well next year. It's 2 to 3 years out. But like I said, this is just a discussion item because we've talked about water again and again, and this is a critical, I feel like this is a critical juncture where we have to make some serious decisions about what we do. Cottonwood Well was built, and you might hear residents that were around the time say Cottonwood Well was built as a redundant well. That may have been the intent when it was built, but it is not the reality now, not with the current usage. So I've jabbered on for a number of minutes, and I apologize, but I wanted you to understand the situation.
So can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
You just mentioned Cottonwood. So this is about 452 BB.
Mm-hmm.
How deep is that one?
What is that?
960.
But it also sits up front too.
Yeah.
So would it be wise for us? I mean, I think you've raised some really good questions and dilemmas as far as storage versus wells. I mean, we talked a little bit earlier this year about do we drill another well or whatever. I mean, and we have some finances to do something. Should we wait till we get our report from
yes.
Okay.
Yes, we're not going to jump the gun and get ahead of this capital projects, because I would hate to say, well, we're going to have
really what are you? I mean, do you have any strong leanings? I mean,
let me chime in, because we've got a bid out to on the state website right now. We're receiving some bids for some hardware and software for meter reading. With that, along that, there's a sample of meters that would be distributed, secondary water distributed throughout the city. If we can start a metering program in the city, we're going to start seeing a decrease in that demand curve, which will alleviate some of the pumping needs. Staff, I myself is oscillated between replacement and new well. I don't know which one I support more. Right now, I'm kind of leaning towards the new well because Harvey still has a life in it, and given that we let it sit for a while, that water table can regenerate to a certain degree. But it can't be the main production that we have relied on year over year. But I know on staff, we've had some healthy discussion about where we should go with this. And so I would ask, I know Charlotte had some feelings, ask him to chime in too.
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, it would be nice if we could just tackle one every 3 years and not have to, use financing, but if they come back and say we need to do more than one, then we'll and we are applying for grants to keep the cost at a minimum. But, you know, if it's an emergency, we'll do what we have to. But ideally, I think most of us think we need a well first, and then meters, and then storage. But if they say we need to do one of them faster than the other, then we'll listen to them, because they're the experts.
Yeah. Is that the priority? You guys agree with that priority? I mean, you guys are... Kevin's,
yeah. Yeah, I just my input on it. I think one of the critical things we need is the experts' advice on the aquifer depths. If we can simply do a replacement on the Harvey well by going deeper, similar to what we're at on the Cottonwood aquifers, then that is a very viable option. And with, if we can get reduction in our irrigation use, then that alleviates the need, immediate need for additional storage, because we'll have the capacity to keep the tanks we have now full. Part of a problem is we can't pump enough water into the tanks to keep up and maintain the fire reserve. With Harvey Well going down at this point, that creates an excessive use of the American Fork water.
So, I mean, I'm no expert by any means, but I'm just wondering if some of this water decrease is the result of Pleasant Grove water users piping that thing, and now we don't have water from that ditch going down into
the generating. Exact same thing we're talking about.
Right?
The final position, that's some of that generation source is gone.
Yeah.
Additionally, if you drive up Cedar Hills Drive to the east from Harper Park, from Heritage Park, Pleasant Grove has a well house that's just right up the street, that's about 3 blocks away maybe. That's got a strong sink ring.
Oh, on the corner.
I think they have two, actually. They have two wells, they can't operate at the same time, so they alternate.
Because, yeah, they're at the same time, they both...
So we're not the only ones using the
aquifer. And they were old irrigation wells too, right? I mean,
So our goal with like the meters, we're applying for a $2 million grant right now. It's a minimum 50. It's due November 1st. We won't hear back for another 6 months. In the meantime, we're trying to install some over time, and we're going to try to educate the residents before we start charging them. But we wouldn't even start changing the rates till everyone got one. But we'd try to educate them first on what they're using.
We've talked about this before. We talk about water a lot. But just so people know, the only time we ever see a decrease in the water is weather. That's it. It's not education. It's not begging people. It's nothing works but weather. If it's cooler, the watering goes down. If it rains, the watering goes down. Nothing else we do gets people to monitor their water. The state's saying that to us too. The meters are coming. They're not. It's not just Cedar Hills. It's not just Big Brother or government overreach. Meters are coming.
It's every city. It's every city in counties of a certain size.
Yeah. So it's not just Cedar Hills, and it's not something we're going to be able to even prevent. So we've got to get on board and make it get.
This is just a discussion. I'm happy to answer more questions, but this is just a discussion. I want you to be aware that we have engaged Cancel and Loose. We anticipate that there will be a report, I would assume probably what we see at the beginning of next year, and as finality that we'll present to you and work on. Charles mentioned a grant, or it's the
Water Smart
grant, that $2 million working for engineer for that application. We have the ARPA money, as I mentioned before. Tomorrow I'm filing two grants at the state. There's $50 million that they've made available for water, sewer, housing, fiber projects. We're applying for two grants. I'll be honest, I'm a little bearish on whether the city gets that, but we're going to apply anyway. But you are now aware of what's happening, but any other questions on this?
Thank you. And thank staff for a good amount of time to put in that.
Okay, thank you. Our last item tonight is a discussion on the rebranding.
We must be going to punch. Because we did this back in 2012,
We had engaged a company called Radiate Creative, and they went around and looked at communities around us and said, okay, what are their brands, what are their slogans, what are they all about? And so this is the Cedar Hills logo. Highland apparently didn't have a logo at the time, which might seem strange, but Alpine has this logo, Pleasant Grove has their logo, you've seen all over. American Fork has this, I call it Schoolhouse Rock, but that's what it is. Then you have the Lehigh logo, which I believe is a stream of mountains, and then you have that really old Warren logo. This was just a few years ago. If I go to what those logos are for those cities now, Highland has a logo. It's the kind of abstract mountain canyon. Alpine has the same logo. American Fork's updated theirs to the rising wagon wheel sun. And Lehigh has their logo, which I actually personally like a lot. Orms updated theirs, and Cedar Hills and Pleasant Grove currently remain the same. So it's very typical for cities to periodically go through a rebranding process and take, okay, what's important to our community, and kind of envision a new, fresh look. One of the reasons that staff has kind of wanted to look at rebranding over the years is this logo is very difficult to use. Especially difficult to use on golf. So last year we actually got a new logo for golf, and the feedback we received from it, Greg, what do you think?
Fantastic.
It's great. We've got a lot of positive feedback from people on that. So we've engaged with Chase Media, the same people that did the golf logo. We engaged with them to help us reimagine our logo. We are not obligated to adopt it, just like we did last time. They drove some logos for us, and City Council didn't really like any of them, and we said we're not going to do this. But we're going to do this again, because I think this is important, because I think that we have a good opportunity to freshen up the look of the city, you know, and give us a new look, along with a tagline and some marketing proposals and some rules on how we market the city. Because essentially we are competing against other cities. We want the city to, you know, compete with those around. We want to have that same air of quality that the other communities do. So we're actually meeting, and I wanted you to understand that, because the mayor and Councilman Smith and I and some staff members have been working with this company, and I believe tomorrow we're going to see the initial drafts of their brand. We're going to give them some feedback. So we wanted you to be aware that this engagement is taking place, and that we're going to be coming back to the council. Obviously, staff is not going to just adopt the logo and you walk in one day and there's new logos everywhere. We're going to come back to the city and get city council's opinion, and I imagine it goes through a number of iterations before anything is finally adopted. Any thoughts?
I just wanted to mention that the council has been aware, obviously, that we've been meeting. It's not news for the rest of the council. And then, you know, we have to choose who gets to come to those meetings because we can't have a quorum. So we don't all get to come to those meetings. That would be deliberation, right?
Yes.
It's not enough to be. So we kind of go with who can be there and those sorts of things. But we're not screening anything new on the council, and that's why we limit the number of people who can come to those meetings or companies and things like that. It's been a fun process, though.
It's fun.
Been fun. Yeah.
I'm really interested. It's going to be great. I can't wait to see you tomorrow.
I think it's looking at something a little more simple, easier to embroider that thing.
Yeah. Less broccoli, yes.
That's where I'm heading, is just less broccoli.
All right. For the record, I like the broccoli.
I know, you do.
I have been a fan of it since 21 years. I've lived here.
So Mike's going to be sad.
I love anything. I love cedar trees, so.
Those aren't even real cedar trees.
What we talked about was you maybe using it like the Jazz do for a city logo. Special jerseys we issued.
Or just for you.
I have no problem with the new golf logo, though. I think it looks good.
So hopefully we have something to talk about.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, well, I think we're done with the meeting. I think we're making a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion to adjourn.
Thank you. Councilor Smith, do you have a motion or a second?
Second.